You're listening to The World Is Just a Book Away podcast. I'm James Owens, founder and CEO of The World Is Just a Book Away, a nonprofit organization on a mission to promote literacy and education by developing libraries and programs in disadvantaged communities around the world. For more information about The World Is Just a Book Away, please visit www.wijaba.org. That's WIJABA.org. My guest today on The World Is Just a Book Away podcast is Shobha Day, one of India's best-selling authors. Shobha has published 20 books, four of which are course material at the University of London. Ms. Day has been named as one of the 50 most trusted people in India, one of the 50 most powerful women in India, and one of the 100 most impactful Indians. She has also been cited as one of the five great Indian writers who changed the meaning of books. I am also very honored that she is a contributor to my book, The World Is Just a Book Away. In our conversation, Shobha and I discuss the power of words, the importance of literacy, and writing the stories of one's own environment. So Shobha, I know I've had obviously the honor of having you as one of the participants in The World Is Just a Book Away and your beautiful submission, and thank you for doing that. And also,
I just love the whole concept, and what you're doing is fantastic. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. And also your I've had an opportunity to learn more about your amazing background from being a model and a commentator, and your blog, and your more than 20 best-selling books, and from what I understand, over 3 million Twitter followers.
Something disgusting like that, yes.
Yes, and I think it really shows the power of words, you know, in a different form, but the power of words.
Well, words have to be used so carefully, so responsibly, and with some amount of, a great deal of investment, because each word has some value, and that's how I look at it. But tweets are a different, very potent, very important new way of expressing oneself. And for someone from my generation, it takes a little time to get the hang of it and to use words concisely and to convey what you wish to convey without landing into too much trouble, which, alas, I frequently do.
Do you find that you have to spend a great deal more time with something like Twitter because you have so few words that you can use?
No, I got the hang of it pretty quickly, actually, because I like the idea of the discipline of Twitter, 140 characters. Of course, now it's been increased. But to be able to say what you want to say, it's a discipline in itself. And therefore, you use and weigh each letter of the alphabet, hoping that what you're saying in those 140 characters has the required impact on the people who are your followers. And I use Twitter quite judiciously. I don't tweet like a maniac all day. I tweet when there's something to say, which is of maybe national or even more ambitiously international importance. And I don't use it to tell the world I've just had the most amazing meal or I've just sneezed and don't you want to know how that sneeze went?
Well, obviously, you have an amazing talent with words. In reviewing your biography, I also learned very recently that you're listed among the 70. Your work, Socialite Evenings, is listed among the 70 most important books in 70 years in India, and also that you are featured at position, you were featured at position 93 in 2017 of the 200 most influential and inspirational authors. a list led by Rowling, J.K. Rowling.
Yes, all these lists are flattering, I suppose, if you take them terribly seriously and let them distract you, which I don't. All lists are necessarily subjective and fairly arbitrary. So till you reminded me right now, honestly speaking, it's not something that I have thought about in any depth or with any seriousness. Maybe I should, but it's not part of my character to dwell too much on things of that kind. These are lists made by other people. These are subjective. And you can use the power of such a list if you are looking at a constituency, if you're looking for a position in government, which I'm not. I'm merely a writer trying to tell my story and trying to tell stories and communicate my love and passion for the written word in my own way. But it is something, I suppose, from a publisher's point of view, would be considered important. So I don't mock it. I don't undervalue it. I'm just being modest in a way that is, well, becoming, I hope.
I think you succeed at that. Before we go move on, Shobha, to the importance of reading and books in life, I just want to ask you if you had to choose a book of yours, one of your own books, for people to read. If you had to select one for people to read who hadn't read your work before, what would you recommend that they read?
Well, you know, the first book always stays pretty special for any writer. It's the first book I wrote was a commissioned book, a novel. I hadn't even thought of getting into writing novels or books at that point. I was a columnist. So I wrote Socialite Evenings more as a challenge. And it was written straight up, straight from the heart. It was spontaneous. It was organic. It was talking about an India that most of India didn't know existed, actually. Forget the rest of the world. So Socialite Evenings definitely, I would say, provides an insight into what is now being referred to as the new India. But even way back then, it was my India. It was the India I knew best. I've grown up in a city which is very metropolitan, cosmopolitan, very modern, very contemporary, breaks all the possible conceivable cliches about India. And what I wrote in Socialite Evenings was my truth. I mean, I think the first book always is pretty self-revelatory for writers across the board, because you are writing about a subject that is closest to yourself, a subject that you know best, which is your immediate environment and quite often yourself. So there are bits and pieces of me definitely in Socialite Evenings, but it's really about an emerging India that was quite dazzling, glittering, affluent, and a far cry from the cliched image of India as poverty-stricken, disease-filled, filthy country with no hope. I always believed there was enormous hope for India. We were a young nation, a young country, and I always believed that Mumbai was an important symbol of all that young Indians aspired to be. And I'm glad I wrote the book the way I wrote it, though I have to tell you it's quite amusing that at the time when it was written, which was quite a long time ago, 30 years ago, people imagined that an area in Mumbai that I described called Malabar Hill, which exists and still does, was my version of Beverly Hills. And I had invented Malabar Hill to fit in with a certain kind of Hollywood novel, a Hollywood novel which talked about extremely rich, affluent people with low morality. But that was the Mumbai that I had seen firsthand and at close quarters. And Malabar Hill and all the people I described in Socialite Evenings existed back then and exist even now.
Mm. And I certainly will add that to my own reading list. And I want to say, Shobha, I'm intrigued by the title of your latest book, 70 and to Hell with It.
when, you know, turning 70 for me in January was a moment that really freed me and liberated me on so many different levels I could not have imagined possible. I wrote a book when I turned 50. I wrote a book when I turned 60. And 70 was quite unplanned. You know, it's like having a baby at 70. It's kind of freaky. And you find different aspects of yourself that have been perhaps buried for too many years under layers of other people's expectations. And suddenly you have grown wings and you're flying high, you're flying. You are not insensitive to the people around you, but you are also extremely sensitive about your own self at 70. And each day and each moment becomes valuable in a different way and extremely important and precious. And you live that moment very fully. And I find myself doing that all of this year in a way that I find selfishly perhaps quite wonderful.
Beautiful. Well, let's take a step back and talk about, as you write about In the World is Just a Book Away, what importance would you say books and reading have played in your life?
When I was growing up in a bureaucratic home with not that much, my family didn't have that kind of money to splurge on expensive gizmos and toys and what perhaps other children in my class showed off and had, but I grew up with books because my father was a great voracious reader himself, and he had made sure that we were always surrounded by books. If he had extra money to spend on a family of four children, all school going and in college at that time, he would spend that extra rupee on acquiring a classic. So I grew up surrounded by classics, and they really, in a sense, became my best friends. And also where I, in a way, escaped into a world which was so completely different from my own and so fascinating and so enchanting. And even as a young girl in school and college, I started to read Russian classics or great American and English writers. And their world was something that I was immersed in and identified with. And I often wondered, had my father exposed us to perhaps writers in regional languages from India, would my world view have been qualitatively different? I'm sure it would have. But that was not possible because at the time when we were all growing up, we went to schools that what were called convent schools. And I was actually in a Protestant school run by a Scottish mission, and I was taught, my early teachers were all Scottish ladies. And later I went to a Spanish Jesuit college. So my natural exposure was to something that was completely different and alien from my immediate environment. And today, I don't regret that at all. I think it enriched my life on so many different levels.
And you mentioned In the World is Just a Book Away that you, at a certain phase of your life, you began asking yourself these questions that you're talking about. Why hadn't you discovered the works in your native language? And in particular, and correct me if I mispronounce this, you say you still hadn't discovered Mahabharata. Is that correct?
Yes. Absolutely perfect pronunciation. Mahabharata, yes. And Krishna, the protagonist.
And
it's one of great epics which continues to inspire generations of Indian readers.
And I have not read that myself, even though one of my major goals in writing The World is Just a Book Away when I started it in editing it was to have a reading list for myself. So now I have this wonderful reading list, but no time to read. little time to read.
That sounds familiar.
What age were you around when you discovered Mahabharata?
Well, the Mahabharata is part of our growing up years, even before we can read, because these are stories that are narrated to us by our parents and our grandparents. And the Mahabharata surrounds every Indian in ways that are quite extraordinary, because these are the stories that are part of our oral tradition. And it's also through plays and through dance dramas that we get acquainted. And through our religious festivals, a lot of the festivals revolve around Krishna and the characters from the Mahabharata. Like Krishna's birthday is around the corner all across India. It's called Janmashtami. And we just grow up absorbing these stories without ever actually attempting to read the Mahabharata, which is an epic. And it's written in a language that's not accessible to most Indians, not even an earlier generation. You had to be proficient in Sanskrit. It's like saying a young student somewhere would want to read something written in Latin, but will have to settle for a translation. So Sanskrit is not anymore the living language it once was. So I wish I could have been exposed to it much earlier, but I was always exposed to it in a different way.
And what importance do you think literacy plays? So now you're by saying you were always exposed to it, we touch on the importance of oral tradition in societies and how stories filter through societies. Mm-hmm. In terms of written tradition, what importance do you think literacy plays? And I think you've probably observed a great increase in literacy rates in India over the course of your lifetime. What importance do you think literacy plays in the world?
Well, literacy is everything. Literacy is power over yourself. It's literacy is about your future. It's about empowering yourself to participate more fully in every aspect of life around you. So for me, the fact that we continue to be a nation where literacy levels aren't what they ought to be as compared to other parts of the world is something I find extremely distressing. And literacy as a government initiative that needs to be our top priority is something not just myself, but every literate Indian is acutely conscious about and actively works towards promoting in whichever way and helping those who don't have access to basic education to get that access somehow. You can do that by supporting children in villages who don't have money to pay the fees. You can do it immediately within your own domestic life. The help in your home, some of whom may not have the resources to educate, particularly the girl children, you make sure that they have the resources available to them so that the girls can get a fair education and make a better life for themselves in future. So there's no question of ever, ever underestimating the power of literacy, especially in a large and fairly unwieldy society and country like ours.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And one of the, as you know, the profits from the world is just a book away. The book go to the charity and to build libraries, provide access, yeah, and give educational programs to children. And it really always breaks my heart when I see children who don't have access to books or reading or educational programs, and also touches me very uniquely. I don't know if you've ever seen this or if it's a custom in India, but in Indonesia, I experience frequently children who will kiss a book and touch it to their forehead because it's so special to them.
I have seen that many, many times in India, because in India, we worship the goddess of knowledge, and the goddess of knowledge is treated with utmost reverence. And even if we accidentally step on a newspaper which is on the floor, or we accidentally step on any written word anywhere, it could be a scrap with something written on it, immediately we apologize and we do touch our foreheads and show our reverence to the written word through that gesture. So it is something that I've grown up with, and I have to say that despite all the so-called assumed modernity that we may project on special days, on special occasions, during our festivals and during the holy month of Shravan, which is going on right now, the written word holds a very special place. And when we start our new year in Diwali, which is the equivalent of Christmas in the Western world, we often, and during Dashera in particular, which is the victory of good over evil, which is just before Diwali, there is a puja, a little religious ceremony in most Hindu homes, where we worship our books, our textbooks, or any book that is of significance in our lives. We actually worship it and place flowers on it to show respect. And if we have switched from writing with ink and pens and paper and using physical instruments to communicate our thoughts, we worship our laptops. I do it every year. I create a little sign on my laptop, which is a religious symbol of respect. And I place betel nut leaves and a betel nut and vermilion, which signifies something auspicious that is to begin, and a pinch of turmeric, and rice grains, which are for fertility and prosperity. I place all of this on my laptop before I start my new year as a writer. So it is something which is deeply, deeply a part of our culture and our lives. And I hope my children and grandchildren continue the tradition.
What a beautiful tradition. And speaking of your children and grandchildren, I'll share with the reader, the listeners, that our connection actually came through a former student of mine, Sahil, who is now your son-in-law, correct?
That's right.
With your married to your daughter, Arundhati.
Yes.
And I get Sahil sends me through WhatsApp periodically pictures as your beautiful grandson grows up.
Oh, he is gorgeous.
Which must be such a joy to you.
It's enormous, yes.
Is he your first grandchild?
Well, we have five grandkids, and I had two before little Ariman was born. And then in 1 year, our three daughters produced three little boys, like pop, pop, pop. It was like something out of slot machines. So now we have five kids and three little grandsons and two gorgeous, gorgeous school-going little girls. And whether it's Aryaman or the two little girls, we make sure we always present them with books. Right now, of course, they can't read. The older one can read, but the little ones can't. But they can identify words, they can identify pictures, and they can connect that books are an important part of their lives, as they are in the lives of their grandmother and their grandfather and, of course, their own parents.
And did you, I'm assuming that you did, but I'll pose it as a question. Did you read to your own children when they were growing up?
I tried to. I have to say I haven't been that. I see my daughters being far, far more responsible and responsive in that department. I think I was a bit too busy writing, and I neglected that aspect of my duties as a mother, reading to my kids. I just made sure there were a lot of books around and sort of said, go read these books, kids, and ask me questions if you need to. But I didn't actively read to them, which I now regret.
But of course, you were also transmitting the importance of words because they would see you writing and they had the access to books.
Yes, of course. But at that point, when they were very young, it used to actively annoy a few of them who would say, my God, there she goes scribbling again. So to them, it wasn't a vocation they could identify with. They thought I was actually doodling or scribbling or God knows what mother was up to. But it wasn't something they took very seriously, and which was quite amusing, because had I been a lawyer or a doctor or been in any one of those conventional careers, perhaps I would have got more respect from my children at that early age. I still work very hard to get that respect, let me tell you.
Yes, I find that children are our best critics. They're very open about sharing our faults. Do you find that?
Oh, gosh, yes. They can be merciless. But at the same time, they are so truthful that, you know what they're saying almost 90% of the time. A, it's bang on. And I pay very close attention when they respond to a book or particularly my columns. And I write 4 a week. So that's a lot of reading for them. And I don't expect them to read and respond to every column that's out there. But when they do respond, and if they do pay me a compliment for something I've written that morning, it's very precious to me, because I know it comes from the heart. And that goes for what my husband also says about my books or my columns or anything that I may blog about. Equally, if they criticize it, they have a valid criticism that I, at that moment, I feel very touchy and I say, no, how could you misread what I'm saying? But when I think about it, most of the time, they're really quite accurate about how they see my work in the public space, and I value that opinion greatly.
Yes, I agree. The same with my son. My son is always very happy to share his opinion of things that they do. And when it comes out in the form of a compliment, it means a great deal to me.
Yeah, it really is. I give myself an extra glass of wine that evening.
Do you think you'll read to your grandchildren?
I doubt it, because A, their mothers are very conscientious, and the grandkids, they live with their parents. It's not a joint family any longer. So when they come here, I'd rather just, you know, hang with them and chat with them and observe them and see what they're all up to and enjoy them, rather than sit them down and maybe read to them. I should try it. I'm not sure. I don't know. You know, I'll be competing with all kinds of other electronic gizmos, which I don't dare compete with because I know I'll lose. But the way that they are receiving their stimuli and their interests in things other than a physical book is also part of today's life. It's part of this century of learning in a very different way. So I'll try, but I'm not sure. A, I don't have that level of patience. I don't know that I'll be a very good reader. I'd rather act out a story, because I'm quite a good mimic and I mime well. So let me see. I'm going to give it a crack.
Oh, wonderful. And I think, and as you mentioned, you're impressed with the way their mothers are reading to them. And I think children love it when we act out stories, and that's a wonderful way to bring them to life.
To go back, sorry to interrupt you, but schools today, especially I notice it with the little ones, they are far, far more proactive with kids, and they don't just read out books to them, but the whole experience of sharing a book in a tiny classroom with 7 or 8 kids is very different from the time I was growing up. And I only got to go to school when I was 7 years old. And here are these kids who are 1 and a half, and they're already attending play schools, going on play dates, attending all kinds of classes. And they're just so smart. But the teachers themselves are very sensitive to exposing them to books which are appropriate for their age and making books attractive to them.
Yes, very important, especially at a young age. I think at any age, really. And What role do books, other than the roles that the books that you write, what role do books and reading play in your life now?
Well, I have to sheepishly confess that I'm no longer the greedy, insatiable reader I used to be, because A, my own writing hours consume a lot of my time. And the rest of the time, I have to keep up with what's going on in the world, which cuts into my time to read and enjoy something the way I would want to. And we are bombarded with so much information that sometimes it seems such a loss that we are spending so much time cramming our brain with that overload when we could really be just relishing a beautifully crafted sentence written by a great writer. I keep going back and revisiting a few old books that I have enjoyed and reading a couple of pages or maybe five pages just to immerse myself in the beauty of a sentence. Doesn't happen that often, but I try.
I just myself, last night, I finished The Great Gatsby, which I probably hadn't read in 20 or 30.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Mm. Oh, my God. Yes.
So much joy.
And tender is the night.
Yes, the beauty of the way he wrote and the constructed sentences. I found that it did relax my brain and take me away from going in all different directions at once, and I was able to immerse myself in that experience.
Well, for the last few days, ever since our great, I claim him, and I'm very proper to real with, I'd have no business to be, V.S. Naipaul, the Nobel laureate, passed this week, and I started to reread all his old work, especially House for Mr. Biswas, which is a really terrific read. Before he started writing strong, provocative nonfiction, he had already made a huge name for himself as a novelist. And I kept marveling over his control, over his craft, his prose and his imagery and how real and vivid everything appeared. Even if he was describing an old meat safe in their kitchen, he took, you know, three loving paragraphs to describe it, including the scraped paint and the wire mesh that covered the front. These are writers that they just dazzle with their brilliance, and one can never stop gasping each time you read a sentence like it's the first time you've read it. You may have read it, but that could have been many years earlier, and you may have forgotten it. To revisit Naipaul for me has been the biggest treat of last week.
Mm. And thank you for highlighting that. Perhaps it will encourage some of our listeners to visit him for the first time or to revisit him, because his prose truly is beautiful. And I might, in fact, make that the next one of his works, the next book that I read. Shobha, is there anything else you'd like to add about reading or books, or in fact, given your very interesting life and take on life in general?
But books have to be, you know, to use the word energizing is a bit of a cliche, but some people like a workout in a gym to feel fit and fantastic and gorgeous. And I feel the same way when I read a passage which has moved me very much. And I feel like my brain is doing calisthenics and I am energized in a way that is indescribable. And it's like a tonic, and it's wonderful. So right now I'm reading something. I might show it to you because it's right here, and I'm so much a part of that book. I'm launching it next week for this wonderful lady. I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah. Arts of Seduction? The Arts
Yes.
of
Seduction? Yes, absolutely. And she is an academic, and she has done this incredible book, which is a treatise and a commentary on one of our great books called the Kama Sutra, which the world, of course, is aware of as an erotic book about impossible sexual positions to assume to heighten pleasure. But it's much more than that. It's not a book about positions. It's really a philosophy of how to make life much more sensual in the true sense of the word. And she calls herself an erotologist, if I'm not mistaken. But the book is a deconstruction of the Kama Sutra, and it opens your eyes to beauty more than anything else, and the importance of love and passion and sensuality, which we very often tend to ignore or overlook or not pay the right kind of attention to. So I'll be in conversation with this wonderful lady next week, and I read the book closely and enjoyed it very much.
Excellent. Shobhade, I want to thank you for, first of all, for participating in The World is Just a Book Away, which, as you know, took 15 years and is very close to my heart, and for the beautiful message that you sent me after you received your book. I want to thank you for your love of words and for creating the works that are read by millions of people. And I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. And I look forward to meeting you in person when I make it to India.
We absolutely must. And I'm so honored to be a part of such a wonderful project. And I wish you all success and all luck, and God bless.
Thank you. God bless. And please give my love to the family.
I shall.
You've been listening to a podcast production of AW360, the year-round content destination from Advertising Week. Visit AW360 at 360.advertisingweek.com and be sure to check out the other AW360 podcasts now available on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Producers on this podcast are Jack Hirschman and Richard Larson, with music provided by Audio Network. For more information on Advertising Week, the world's largest gathering of advertising, marketing, and technology leaders, now in 6 markets across the globe, visit www.advertisingweek.com.